and that is on page 2, line 14. So under the service, the early education program, parent training, school readiness, kindergarten, we would insert voluntary home visits for in-home educational opportunities, giving the school districts the discretion to use some of those good programs.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Crecia, I think that makes sense. I think those voluntary home visits are probably very expensive, but I think if a school district determines that that is something that needs to be done in a particular case-by-case basis, I would include that under the other outreach efforts that is included in that subdivision, but certainly if Representative Crecia wanted to spell out voluntary home visits as well, I think I would be willing to do that.
So, just to get it straight, you're okay with A2 then?
Yeah, I think the A2, that makes sense.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Crecia, do you want to go ahead on A3?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Mullery. On A3, we would, on page 3, we'd insert on 13, school district that uses basic skills revenue for programs designed to prepare children and their families for school under Subdivision 1, Clause 10, may provide those services directly, contract for those services, or distribute grants to parents to purchase those services directly. Again, giving a little bit more local control to our schools and allowing them to choose how they would like to see this program implemented.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crecia, that's, again, I don't think I'd be comfortable with that. I don't think that distributing the grants to parents in this particular situation is ideal. I think school districts, school boards, local school boards, and the school administration and the staff have a responsibility from the state to make sure kids are ready for kindergarten, and this is designed to help them do that, not somebody else.
So that would be a no then?
I don't think I would support that at this time.
Sure. And on, thank you, Chair Mullery. On page 1, line 12, after 4, we would insert entry into school whether the student first enrolls in or after kindergarten, and insert or first grade. Again, on this one, it would be including the K and the first grade.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crecia, I discussed that with my superintendent, and he believes that we could do that under current law anyway, and so that seems like that would be perfectly fine. So I think that would be all right, too.
So A4 is okay.
A4 seems fine to me. Yep.
We know about the amendments now. Representative Morgan, why don't you explain your bill, and we can have questions on it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, some members of the committee, I appreciate your having me in here to hear House File 393. We have heard, consistently, I think what we all agree on down here is that we need to fix the achievement gap, and that we need to get parents more involved as a key to fixing the achievement gap. And this bill is an attempt to help to do that. This is not the silver bullet, certainly, but I think this is one step in the right direction. It will provide greater flexibility for school districts to provide outreach, to help students prepare for kindergarten, and help the parents of students, especially at-risk students, prepare for kindergarten. I have with me Superintendent Randall Clegg from the Burnsville School District, my boss, School District 191, also a former school board member and all-around student activist, Vicki Roy, from Burnsville, and Tom Umhofer, who is Director of Community Education Programs in Burnsville. I'm not sure if they want to stay over there, if they want to come over here, but they'll certainly be available for questions. But Dr. Clegg has a few words to say about the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Clegg. Thank you, Representative Morgan, Chair Mueller, members of the committee. My name is Randall Clegg, and I am superintendent for the Burnsville Egan Savage School District. Today, I'm here to encourage your support for House File 393, allowing basic skills revenues to be used for programs that are designed to prepare children for kindergarten and parent training. Over the past 10 years, the Burnsville Egan Savage School District has experienced dramatic demographic changes, as many school districts in the state of Minnesota. Once a school district with fewer than 20% of students qualifying for free and reduced price meals, today we are a school district proudly serving a rapidly changing racially, ethnically, and economically diverse population of students. Nearly 50% of our students today identify themselves as non-white. 50% of our students qualify for free and reduced price meals, and 24% of our students speak one of 83 languages other than English. As a school district, we pride ourselves in our commitment to preparing all students to be career and college ready. Over the past several years, we have led the state of Minnesota in the number of credits students have earned through the College and the Schools program. Over the past 2 years, we're one of 11 Minnesota school districts that have increased the number of minority students participating in advanced placement courses without decreasing the percentage of students earning a 3 or better on their AP exams. Over the past 2 years, we've expanded our partnerships with Inver Hills Community College and Dakota County Technical College to provide the middle 50% of our students with the academic skills necessary to successfully transition to a post-secondary institution and take credit-bearing courses. And finally, we're one of many Minnesota school districts that implemented AVID, which stands for Advancement via Individual Determination. It's a program which targets students who could potentially be the first children in their family to go to college, providing them with the organizational and thinking skills necessary to achieve this goal. As much as we have expanded our efforts to prepare all of our students to be career and college ready, we are increasingly aware that the experiences a child has at home before they even enter kindergarten has a tremendous impact on their academic performance throughout their school years. We know there's a significant correlation between parents reading to their children every day and a child's reading ability. Yet across this country, only 1 in 2 parents read to their children daily, and 1 in 10 parents freely admit that they never read to their children. Besides reading to their children, parents can do many other things to help their children develop the skills necessary to achieve academically in school, such as sharing stories, guiding TV watching, taking trips, having books available, and setting high expectations. The more parents are engaged with their children in developing linguistic skills and print knowledge, the better prepared children are for the academic rigors of the 21st century. Decades of research shows that when parents are involved in guiding their children's learning at home, students have higher grades, higher test scores, higher graduation rates. School attendance is better, students have increased motivation to excel, and there are fewer disciplinary referrals. Increased family participation is also a powerful way to break the predictive factor of a family's socioeconomic status on a child's school success. The more parents are involved at every level, including at home and at school, the better students achieve. Unfortunately, what we're learning and what the research literature confirms is that as much as parents want their children to be successful, many parents simply do not know how to help their children with their education. We believe with guidance and support, parents can and will become increasingly involved in home learning activities, creating opportunities to teach and guide their children. In Minnesota, basic skill revenues provide school districts with the resources necessary to support children who are struggling academically. However, as the statute is currently written, there is no clear authority for school districts to use basic skills revenues in support of parent training programs and school readiness programs. The language revisions proposed in House File 393 doesn't ask for more money, but rather it seeks the authority to invest some of these revenues in the child's first teacher, their parents. At this time, I'm going to turn my comments over to Vicki Roy, who will talk about efforts in our community to build community advocacy around early literacy, and Tom Umhofer, who will share information about programs we're piloting in our school district focused on helping parents become their child's first teacher and strongest advocate. Thank you.
Dr. Roy.
Chair Muller.
No, Representative Krishna.
Just quickly, Chair Muller, I think it would be appropriate if we just withdraw amendments 1 and 3, A1 and A3.
Okay.
That would probably be the easiest.
Yeah. You'll remember that.
Yeah. Well, we're not formally started, but I will remember. I've got it. She's going to write that down. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Vicki Roy, and as Representative Morgan told you, I'm a past school board member in the Burnsville Egan Savage School District and Intermediate District 917, and I currently co-chair an early literacy committee that formed as a result of a series of community meetings that identified improving the third grade reading proficiency measure in our school district as an area for our community to work on together. Our focus is on working with families with children 0 to 5 years old to develop and implement strategies that promote and encourage literacy. I'm here today to encourage you to pass House File 393 to allow districts to use compensatory revenue for early education effort and parental training like the kind we have been working toward in ISD 191. Our committee has been working to make our community aware of the risks of children not entering kindergarten ready to learn and to seek out programs that will assure that we are providing opportunities for all children to get the skills they need to be ready. We've been involved in programs that heighten the awareness of the importance of early literacy, like our participation in the National Read for the Record campaign for the past 2 years. We've enjoyed having state leaders like Commissioner Casellas, local legislators, Representative Myra, who isn't here right now, was one of them, mayors and business people read a designated book. This year it was Ladybug Girl and the Bug Squad, and everybody wore their nice little antenna with red boppers on them. And they read to over 3,000 students in our schools and communities to emphasize the importance of early literacy. We made connections with local for-profit and not-for-profit preschools and daycare providers, as well as friends, family, and neighbor providers, and invited them to participate in a 3-part staff development workshop sponsored by our district's Early Childhood Program and Concordia College. The sessions covered the Minnesota Early Learning Standards and using approaches to engage children in literacy. An average of 30 providers attended each of these sessions. So today, lessons taught at our preschools and childcare facilities are more aligned throughout our community. We've worked with Fairview Ridges Hospital to introduce a program called Reach Out and Read, whereby doctors in all the Fairview clinics in Dakota County are giving a book to every child, birth to age 5, who comes in for a checkup. Fairview Ridges Hospital is also providing books to families with babies in their neonatal intensive care unit. We are sponsoring programs for preschool children at Chancellor Manor and Dakota Station, 2 apartment complexes in our communities that house many new Americans. There, parents are enrolled in literacy classes where they are developing skills they can employ to help their children as well as themselves. The Burnsville Morning Rotary has begun reading regularly in our preschool classrooms. We were the recipients of many gently used children's books collected by Dave McDevitt's public affairs class at Burnsville High School, and we distributed those to the families through our Ready for Kindergarten classes last spring. Last summer, we started our Rockin' Readers program at Nicollet Commons Park. Each Thursday, one of our elementary school principals reads to families for 20 minutes just prior to the city-sponsored Rockin' Lunch Hour concerts. They'll be returning again this summer for 10 weeks. We've had the pleasure of speaking to our local Rotary Club about our efforts, as well as to some regional leaders in early childhood education. We've met with our mayors, chamber executives, and several individual business people to introduce our Ready for Kindergarten program. And we'll be hosting an after-hours fundraiser for the program in mid-March. As a result of these efforts, I believe our communities now have a much better understanding of the importance of having children arrive at kindergarten ready to learn and the programs we can offer to help make that happen. Again, I would encourage passage of this bill to allow us to use some of our compensatory funds to help assure our children do arrive at kindergarten prepared to be successful. Thank you.
Thank you. And is Mr. Umhofer going to testify? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Umhofer. I'm the current community education director for the Burnsville Public Schools. I spent 2.5 years prior to coming to Burnsville in Mankato as their director. In that time, we worked on a program to address the need of incoming kindergarten readiness. And at that time, we were seeing 50% of our incoming kindergartners were not ready for school and unprepared for kindergarten. When I arrived in Burnsville in 2007, many of the same things were in place there. 50% of our students were definitely not ready for school, prepared for kindergarten in 1 of 5 critical areas: social, emotional, motor, literacy, and math skills. Many studies show that children who drop out of high school Of those who drop out, half of them are behind before they even enter the kindergarten classroom, and many of those children never make up that achievement gap. We know that from research that by age three there is already a substantial achievement gap between economically disadvantaged and advantaged children in vocabulary and print concepts. And it is common to find a kindergarten classroom with children who are at a three-year-old level and children who are at an eight-year-old level. That is a five-year gap that we need to address, and we need a program to look at how we can address those needs. We identified some areas in our school district and some program must-haves, and some of those must-haves include a program that meets the needs of our culturally and economically diverse population. The program must be affordable, simple, and easy to use. Activities and curriculum must address early learning activities and the child's first and most important teacher, their parents. Participants must mirror our district demographic makeup, moms, dads, grandparents, low-income, high-income, multiple ethnicities. And the program must be comprehensive, including the social, emotional, motor, literacy, and math-building skill assets that we are needing. Our current program we have found is free, meets all of our must-haves. It provides training and support materials for families. And in the first year, we had 160 parents of 4 to 5-year-old children who attended the program. Those children now have just entered our first and second kindergarten and first grades, and with the help of our district assessment staff and teachers, we're in the process of collecting data about the impact of the program and on the readiness skills of those children. This year, over 125 families have enrolled in ages 0 to 5 to begin the new Ready for Kindergarten program this year. Looking ahead, for us, data is one of the most critical pieces of our puzzle to ensure that the long-term success of the program provides quality and affordable opportunities for everybody to be successful. The Children's Reading Foundation has created a curriculum for parents to target readiness skills prior to entering kindergarten. The findings from their studies are showing considerable amounts of savings in remedial costs, money which could be reinvested in the early years to help parents and incoming students. I urge you to consider passing House File 393 to be able to allocate compensatory dollars to help provide the critical link to helping our families and students gain a solid start in their early years so they can even be more successful once they reach school. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kreisha, you're first.
Thank you, Chair Mullery. Just a couple of questions before we get into the, or one question before we get into the amendments. And thank you for the testimony and Representative Morgan for bringing this bill up. The intentions seem to be good, and I think you're on the right track with what you're looking. After listening to the testimony, and I'm certainly not going to go back to an amendment I withdrew, but would it make sense that at a later stage to look at expanding this beyond the 5%, in your opinions? As it sounds like you're trying to do some flexibility, you're trying to do a little creativity, and you're trying to help out in that K and first graders, and I'm just wondering, is there a possibility that we could help you a little bit more beyond the 5%?
I think at this time, keeping the bill consistent, because we're used to practicing, and in our district, we have been able to develop collaboration amongst our 10 elementary schools to accomplish what we might have wanted to do from a district perspective, and I think that makes it even a stronger approach. For example, we're implementing full-day kindergarten this year. We're using compensatory dollars to make that happen, and it's at no cost to any of our families. And that really was a collaboration of all 10 elementary schools working together to leverage that resource to make it happen. We were finding that with the fee-based kindergarten that we were down to under half of our students were actually taking advantage of that because they couldn't afford it. And the ones who basically weren't coming were our low-income families. Our teachers this year, anecdotally, are reporting just having students for a full day, second language students, students who come from homes of poverty, who haven't had those prior experiences that many of us had when we started kindergarten, is just making their jobs so much easier, and they're seeing the growth in their children that they never saw when they only had them for half a day. So through our collaborative efforts, I think there are ways to work around that particular limitation. I think it just forces us to be collaborative.
Thank you. Before we go with another question, we're going to come to formal order. since we had quite a problem of getting the quorum. So the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development has now formally come to order, and we'll go back to Representative Kreisha for another question.
Thank you, Chair Mullery, and thank you for the clarification. Again, I certainly didn't want to force the issue, but I did want an explanation, and that's very, very helpful. So at this time, shall we renew the amendments? Are we ready for that, or would you like discussion?
We can, I will move the House File 393 for passage, and it is sent to Committee on Education Finance. Is that correct? Okay. So the bill's been moved.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan.
If I may, an oral technical amendment. On the amendment, there are two incorrect years. The year is incorrect in two places on the effective dates. On line 2.21 and 3.14, it says for fiscal year 2013. Obviously, that's this year. It should be for next year.
Would you repeat that?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. On line 2.21, it should say for fiscal year 2014, and on line 3.14, it should say for fiscal year 2014. If somebody would be so kind as to move those technical changes, I would
Chair will move
it.
Those two amendments on 3.14 2013 is changed to 2014, and on 2.21 2013 is changed to 2014. Is that correct? All in favor of that amendment to put in the shape the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you. Then Representative Kreisha, do you want to, like on the A1, do you want to move it and then withdraw it, or just not mention it, or just not mention it? Okay, so do you want to move the A2 amendment then?
Yes.
Representative Kreisha moves the A2 amendment, and it's my understanding the author of the bill is fine with that.
Okay. I urge support of the amendment, Mr.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. And Representative Kreisha, do you want to then move the A4 amendment?
Correct.
Kreisha moves the A4 amendment, and the author is okay with that? And
Mr. Chair, I support the A4 amendment.
Okay, thank you. All in favor, say aye. Aye. All opposed, no. Carries, I think, 1-0.
Woohoo!
Okay, next in line is Representative Powell. You had a question? No? Okay, Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for Superintendent. How much compensatory revenue does Burnsville currently receive?
About $8 million.
$8 million. How many students, Mr. Chair, Superintendent, how many students do you have?
9,500 students.
So that, Mr. Chair, Superintendent, how much is that per student?
Dr.
Not quite $1,000, and it's kind of hard because it's partly based on concentration.
Yeah.
So, for example, we have one school where our concentration of free and reduced lunch students is 77%. So that building generates more money than some of the other districts. So it's, the money's going right to the students. So in that building, they're generating almost $1,500 per student.
Sure.
I have other buildings that generate $20-$25 per student. So it does vary across the district based on the concentration within each building.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Superintendent, how do you separate that money in your budget so that that money is used in the way it's supposed to under statute?
Yeah,
Dr. Clyde.
It's distributed to each individual building based on the amount of money that that building generates out of the total compensatory revenues that receive. Each building has to put together a budget on how they're going to use those funds to address the district's student achievement goals.
Representative Barrett.
So then, Mr. Chair, Superintendent, how do you actually do that in each building? Does one building have a class size of 20, for example, the other one 30? How do you make sure that that money gets used to help those folks achieve academic superiority?
Yeah, we did put some criteria together on how a building must develop a plan, and we also put some restrictions on how that money can be used. Basically, we wanted that money to be targeted against for those students who are struggling learners. And so every building has a system of interventions that they have developed within their building that takes students who are not succeeding academically in the classroom. After the teacher has tried in-classroom interventions, we bring interventionists into the classroom, in most cases, to work with the classroom teacher and the students who are struggling academically. We're moving towards basically a mastery learning model, where our goal is that for each essential learning, all of our students are
approaching mastery as they progress through the curriculum.
One more question.
Representative Barrett, one more.
The reason for my my thoughts on this is because I represent a few schools, districts, one of which is on a four-day school week because of a lack of funds. They get about $8,000 per student. Many other districts get much, much more than that. So I look at compensatory revenue. I want to understand it and see if it's actually achieving the goals to which it was originally intended. Mm-hmm. And so I look at this bill then, and we're kind of moving away from the intended goal by 5%. You know, probably good reasons for that. In my mind, however, a district like Burnsville, who gets about $900 per student, obviously you get more, you know, it's not, it doesn't work that way, right, but on average. Whereas my school districts get about $120 or $200, we don't have that flexibility because the money's not there. So even though this might be a really good thing for those that actually receive that revenue, unfortunately, it's not level throughout the state.
I agree with that. And to give you an illustration, 5 years ago, we were only receiving $1.8 million. That's how rapidly our population has changed within Burnsville. So we've seen this very rapid increase in funding for targeting programs for kids who are struggling academically. So honestly, we've had to scramble a little bit to put the structures in place to make sure that what we were doing was actually making a difference in student learning. So there's high expectations at each building level, and how that money is utilized. There's a lot of oversight. And basically, we're looking at what are the outcomes. Are we actually getting more students to proficiency than we were before? And our population continues to increase in challenges, particularly with poverty is huge, and our second language population is 24%. So those are create some unique challenges. The other thing we're working on is how do we align compensatory dollars? We have ESL dollars, we have special ed dollars. How do we align all those dollars that are really designed to help students to be successful to be used efficiently and effectively? So we're not creating silos of functions and services within the district, but it's a coordinated, integrated system of interventions designed to help students succeed. Our purpose for asking for this change is that as we've worked particularly with our low-income and second-language parents, a lot of them have, they want their kids to be successful, and we hear that loud and clear. They want their kids to be successful. Our minority population, our immigrant population want their kids to be part of the American culture. Their challenge is they don't have the background and prior experiences about helping their children be successful before they even come to school. So our Somali families have told us in Somalia, they took their kids to school and dropped them off, and that was their responsibility, to get them to school. It was nothing before that. So that's a real cultural shift for them in thinking about their role as a parent in helping their kids. So we're doing a lot of work for our Somali population. We're bringing programs right to where they live. Many of them live in large apartment complexes, so we're working with apartment complexes. We're bringing teachers and tutors right to them. We're developing the relationships with the parents between the parents and our teachers, so our parents can have that conversation with our teachers about how can I be a stronger advocate for my child. The Ready for K program is intended to provide parents, as their children go from birth to kindergarten, with here's what you can do at home with a one-year-old to help them become academically successful. Here's what you can do with a two-year-old, three-year-old, four-year-old. And they also get a basket of good quality educational resources that they take home to keep, to support the programming. We've had some faculty go through that program and came out and going, I'm a trained educator, and I learned things that I didn't know that I could be doing with my young child before they're coming to kindergarten. So it's a program that we've gotten a lot of very positive response from parents going, wow, now I know what I can do. And all it takes is 20 to 30 minutes a day of a parent interacting with their child, and we're giving them the tools and the training to do it. The other program that we're implementing is a Parent Institute for Quality Education, and basically that's working with school-age families, helping those parents become the strongest advocate they can for their children. So, for example, how many parents know what kind of questions to ask the
teacher?
Doctor,
we have two more big bills on. We really, I mean, it's a great dissertation, but I'm afraid if I don't cut you off, you're going to be here at 7 still answering his question.
Dr. Clegg is retiring this June. I think this is his swan song.
Representative Barrett, we really have to go on.
Sure. Can I just say 10 seconds to follow up?
Okay.
Sure. Thank you. That was a great dissertation on what your district is doing. I appreciate that. You balance that, all the good stuff, with having 5 days of school versus four. That's what I struggle with, but thank you very much. You did a good job.
The chair renews the motion, his motion to pass House File 393 and send it, re-refer it, as amended, sorry, and re-refer it to the Committee on Education and Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. Thank
next
you.
Next bill, does somebody want to move?
Mr. Chair, I move House File 296.
And it,
where is it going?
Sent to HHS Finance.
Yeah, I move House File 296 that we pass it to HHS Finance.
Thank you, Representative Radinovich. And with that, Representative Liebling, just go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you very much, members. And this is a bill, I understand that the committee's already heard several bills that really relate to pieces of the bill that's before you. This is the bill originated with NAMI. It has some elements that I think you've had plenty of conversation about already, and I'm not going to go over those unless you have additional questions on that. But the idea is that there are several bills with some very good pieces in them to help address the problem of deficits in our children's mental health system. And the idea is to get these all to Health and Human Services Finance, to vet the policy, of course, through this committee and also through the Health and Human Services Committee. Some of them have been vetted, and then to see what we can fund, because ultimately that's going to be, I think, our issue. But as I understand it, the two pieces that this committee has not heard before are, the first one is the what's called exception to formulary, which is starts on line 1.8, section 1 of the bill. And then the second part, I believe, is section 3, which is the parent support outreach program. So those, I think, are the two sections that, that this committee has not already heard. And I'm going to turn it over to Sue Abdeholden to discuss these, and I think probably just take member questions if there are some.
Okay. Ms. Abdeholden, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sue Abdeholden with NAMI, Minnesota. The first section was really trying to get at the problem that sometimes, especially young people who are experience their first psychotic episode, have in making sure that they obtain the right medication at the right time and that they're not having to jump through a lot of hoops with drug formularies. The other thing that also happens is that, you know, especially when you're young like that and you want to prevent that second psychotic episode from happening, you want to find the right medication and quickly. And so you may start someone on one, and then they start having some side effects, and they're more likely not to take it. And so you want to be able to quickly switch it to a medication maybe that has different side effects or that they don't react to as much. And if you have to go through a lot of hoops in terms of prior authorization and things like that, it can be problematic. We did meet with the health plans and the Department of Human Services on Friday afternoon, and we are working together to create language that everybody can hold hands and sing kumbaya about, and we'll, you know, be back before it hits the Finance Committee and before it's heard there with language again that everyone can agree to. And I will say that's the same with, although we're not talking about it, the availability of case management services and the transition. We met with the counties on and the department on Thursday, and we're working on language to, again, you know, address everybody's concerns. Under Section 3, Subdivision 1, the Parent Support Outreach Program, this is a pilot which provides early intervention response to families who are kind of have those risk factors for maltreatment. I know that you have already heard before the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences, so this is a way, again, to intervene early and to support those kids.
Thank you. And Representative Kreisch, I believe you wanted to move the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Miller. Yes, I'd like to move the A2 amendment at this time.
And Representative Liebling, do you want to comment on that? Or?
Just, I think it's that would be just fine, Mr. Chair. Okay. We've discussed that, and we have no problem with that.
Thank you. Then all in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Any further questions on this? Looks like not. Then Representative Radinovich renews his motion that 296 be passed as amended and re-referred to HHS Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you. Representative Moran, assume you're moving your bill, House File 739, and it also goes to, oh, this one goes to HHS Policy then. Thank you, Representative Liebling.
Yes, go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 739 to be passed and referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Policy.
Right.
Okay. This is a department bill, and it makes technical changes and clarification to the Child Care Assistance Program and Child Safety and Permanency, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, MFIP, and the Economic Opportunity and Homelessness Service. Before, Mr. Chair, we go any further, there is an amendment that I would like to put in order before we discuss the bill. There's an amendment to the bill.
There's an amendment. Oh, is that this one that doesn't have a number?
So if there is also...
Why don't you discuss it while they're passing it out? Apparently wrong copy was made or something. Go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, if you like, I would like to have our research, Danielle Putinelli, to explain the amendment. And it's also an oral amendment or correction.
Mr. Chair, members, the A1 amendment is, I believe, from the Department of Human Services. It's modifying a few minor pieces of terminology in the bill, and then it's adding a few sections related to verifications of eligibility, and then there's also some sections that are added related to parental rights. That language starts on the bottom of page 4, and there is a typo on page 7, line 1. The word tribal should be deleted and insert trial instead.
So then my understand, did you any other changes other than the one on 7-1? That was the only change.
That's the only change.
Okay, so Representative Moran moves an amendment to her amendment on line 7-1 that the word tribal be changed to trial. Yes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, carries. Then Representative Moran already moved that, and so to get the bill in shape that the author wants, all in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead. Is there any questions on the amendment? Okay. Then, Representative Moran, go ahead with the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Because this is a department bill and very technical, I have here Larry Hosh, who's going to walk us through the bill.
And Representative Hosh never was in a committee I chaired before, so I never got to go after him. Go ahead, Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Larry Hosh. I'm with the Department of Human Services. House File 739 before you is the Children and Family Services Policy Bill. All these provisions have no cost to them, and focus around three simple themes of simplification, mandate reduction, and a focus on outcomes. Many of these provisions are technical in nature and align statute with current practice or current rule. And I'll go through each of the sections that are under Children and Family Services, which includes child care, child safety and permanency, and economic assistance programs like the Minnesota Family Investment Program. Under the Child Care Assistance Program, there's a few policy provisions in this bill. Section 2 updates language for contractual agreements with tribes. Our current statute says that we will reimburse tribes for child care assistance. That is not our current practice. Our current practice is that we directly pay for those child care assistance payments. So we're just updating statute to reflect the current structure of payment. Section 3 in the bill clarifies how we authorize child care. Right now, statute says that we authorize up to 120 hours of child care for a two-week period. Our rule says that we pay for 120 hours of child care for a two-week period. So we're updating statute to align with our rule. Section 4 in the bill identifies two areas in which child care can be authorized for a child within the child's own home. The first instance would be where one of the caretakers is unable to care for the medically unable to care for the child, and the other caretaker is in an authorized activity outside of the home. The second instance would be when a child's nighttime sleep would be disrupted if child care was provided outside of the home. Those are the three policy areas in child care, so I'll move on to child safety and permanency provisions within the bill. One is we expand access to child support data to family members of a child that's interested in the permanency planning of that child. This aligns with federal law, so all privacy considerations still have to align with federal law and state law. The next areas, which are several sections in the bill, 32 through 35, codifies several of the Office of the Legislative Auditor's policy recommendations when they did an audit of our programming. The next sections deal with the Minnesota Family Investment Program, and this is the bulk of the bill. These proposals, again, highlight three areas of mandate reduction, program simplification, and a focus on outcomes and work for our program participants. Sections 6, 12, and 19 deal with our application recertification interviews. At the current time, right now, when there's an application interview, we have to have a face-to-face meeting being conducted with the county and the participant. We expand that and allow for internet telepresence or telephone interviews to occur. This updates our statutes to current technology, offers greater flexibility to the client and to the county, and this still will require that all verification standards that are within our statute still have to be met. So the identity of the person, all income and asset verifications will still have to continue. We're just saying that the interview can be conducted in a different format. Section 7 updates how counties are allowed to value a car for determination of their asset limits. Right now, our statute specifically says that they have to use the NADA guide for loan values. That limits the counties to having to purchase a physical paper book for determining that value, while at the same time, NADA has an online guide that allows for the trade-in value to be assessed. We're simply allowing for that to occur, so the counties don't have to purchase a book. They can use the online guide. Sections 8, 9, and 11 updates cross-references. Two of the cross-references references statutes that were repealed in 2012. The other cross-reference was an errant cross-reference in which it referenced a particular clause that wasn't applicable, and we replaced that clause with the correct one as it was originally intended. Section 10 is for recertifications and allowing for a 30-day period for recertifications. When a recertification occurs for a family on the Minnesota Family Investment Program, they have to supply an eligibility report or a household report form. Sometimes, because of our verification requirements, that takes a matter of time to get bank statements and income statements and all those areas. If because we want to reduce the churning of closing a case and reopening it shortly thereafter, we're going to allow a 30-day window for that recertification to occur. So a county doesn't have to close and reopen cases, but instead pend a case until that recertification is verified. Section 13 is a verification provision, and several of these provisions were also in the amendment. Right now, we not only have to verify eligibility, but we also have to verify ineligibility for a participant. So when somebody is determined to be ineligible because they exceed income guidelines or asset guidelines, the county is still required to get that verification in written form. When somebody has been told that they're ineligible for a program, they have no incentive to come back to the county and provide the documentation to say that they're ineligible. So counties have to keep a case open, pend a case, go back into the system, close it out weeks later. We're simply allowing for a signed personal statement when it's determined that a person's ineligible, a signed personal statement to count as verification. This is a simplification proposal. In Section 14, we are aligning our underpayment policy with what we do for overpayments. For overpayments, we look back 12 months to determine to collect on overpayments. We would do the same thing for underpayments. This is current policy, and we're aligning with current practice. Section 15 and 24 through 29 deals with the Injury Protection Program. The Injury Protection Program is essentially the MFIP Workman's Comp Program. Because MFIP is a work program that tries to get participants into jobs, oftentimes if they are unable to get paid work, they will be placed into an uncompensated work experience program through the county. If they get hurt, there would have to be some protection. The Injury Protection Program is that. And what we essentially do is update our language to be consistent throughout statute. So we have a common reference to community work experience programs. Any of the inconsistencies that's in the statute, we align with one common terminology and verbiage. Section 16 and 17 is another simplification and mandate reduction proposal. This is for employment plan reviews and assessments. There's right now for doing certain reviews of an employment plan or doing a reassessment, a county will have to conduct them either at a six-week interval or a three-month interval. It causes unnecessary meeting time and documentation time. We think if we align those intervals up within one common three-month period, that we'll be able to reduce some of the mandates on the counties, allow them to focus on the employment activities that the Minnesota Family Investment Program was created for in the first place. Section 18 deals with post-secondary education and training approval. Right now, it is solely the responsibility of the participant to provide documentation to meet the standards that would qualify them for pursuing post-secondary or vocational training. We think that's an important role for the employment counselor to also participate in. So we're just updating our statute to allow for the participant and the employment counselor to provide that documentation. Section 21 is the Work Participation Cash Benefit Program, or the Work Benefit Program, which we commonly call it. This aligns our statute with our current policy for how we administer and pay for the Work Benefit Program. This is more of a systems issue alignment than anything. Sections 22 and 23 focuses on our pursuit of focusing on outcomes for the Minnesota Family Investment Program. Right now, we have two different performance measurements, the work participation rate and the self-support index. The work participation rate does not count a participant getting a job as being a success. If a person gets a job, they do not count in our work participation rate. And we think that the goal for the Minnesota Family Investment Program is for a person to leave our programs and to get a job. And so we create a Minnesota measurement called the self-support index that measures when people leave the Minnesota Family Investment Program or are working at least 30 hours a week. What we propose is that we link the entirety of our performance-based funding to the self-support index. Currently, we do a 5% withhold. We give counties 95% of their grant, and then they have to meet the performance guidelines before they get that remaining 5%. And if they don't meet that 5%, counties have to submit a performance improvement plan. That is everything for the Minnesota Family Investment Program provisions. The next one, there is another one with vocational educational training. There's a federal mandate that no more than 30% of our participants can participate in vocational educational training and not count against our work participation rate. What we are proposing is, instead of counting that on a county-by-county level, we would just apply it to the statewide level. And one of the reasons is if we have a teen parent that is on the Minnesota Family Investment Program pursuing high school or their GED, that counts against that limit. If a small county has a couple of those people, they might hit that 30% threshold because just of the size of their caseload. Minnesota will still meet that threshold, that limit that the federal government mandates on us, but we just want to make sure we count it on the statewide level, not a county-by-county level. The last area is in economic opportunity and homelessness services. We have a provision for the base funding for community action agencies, and we have a base funding formula in our statute. We want to make sure that if a community action agency decides to merge, if they feel that it's best for serving their service area, that they're not going to be negatively impacted because of that merger with their base funding. So this would assure totality in their base funding if they were to merge. The last part is on long-term homeless support services. Because homelessness doesn't know county boundaries, we give preference to multi-county partnerships when it comes to these supportive services. We also think it's important to include not only multi-county partnerships, but multi-tribal partnerships. So we update our statute with that. With that, Mr. Chair and committee members, that is the overview of our policy bill.
Thank you, Representative Hosh. You're in the running for the award for most boring presentation of the year. Representative Myra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hosh. Going through all of these changes, are any of them undoing legislation that was passed in the last session?
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the amendment that was brought up earlier, the A1 amendment, does address one of the areas that came out of policy, part of the department policy language from 2012, I believe. It deals with termination of parental rights. Last year, we added two provisions, and if you look back on your amendment, the A1 amendment, on line 5.7 through 5.10, we gave two provisions. One is when the parent committed sexual abuse to their child, and the other is when a parent committed offense that required them to register as an offender. After implementation of this, we received word from county attorneys and counties that provision number 6 was overly restrictive because this not only would apply, this would apply to anybody that had to previously register years and years ago. Because this deals with such a sensitive issue as termination of parental rights, they requested that the department fix this area, and it's supported by the county attorneys and the counties.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, then Representative Moran restates her motion to pass House File 739 as amended and refer it to HHS policy. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. And the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.